On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Radiation Site Cleanup, CERCLA Requirements and Guidance. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxboro, North Carolina. I'll serve as a moderator on today's class. I'm going to cover the first few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors. As we go through the training class today, you are in control of which slide you're on. If you're using the Cluent system, the series of orange buttons along the top are going to allow you to navigate. The double left button, the first orange button, will bring you back to slide one. The single left button is going to take you back one slide. Most often you'll use the third button, the single right arrow, that will move you forward one slide at a time through the presentation. The double right fast forwards you to the last slide of the presentation. The house button takes you back to the presentation overview page where we started today. The slide number is listed in the upper left-hand corner, so the instructors and I will say that as we go through the presentation. Looking back up at the orange buttons, the question mark button is there primarily for our simulcast audience. Our simulcast audience is hearing today's training through their computer speakers instead of over the phone line. The question mark button allows everyone in the simulcast audience to send in a question, and I'll ask that question for you during the question and answer breaks. Anyone is welcome to use that question mark button at any time during today's presentation. If you're in our phone audience, you're welcome to ask your own questions, but we do ask that you wait until the designated question and answer breaks. We're going to have one in the middle of the training and another at the end. Today's training is based on two documents, Determining Cleanup Goals at Radioactively Contaminated Sites Case Studies and Issues of Long-Term Stewardship, State Regulators' Perspective. These documents are available to download if you haven't already, and we'll take you to some links at the end of the training class where you can download these documents. The presentation itself is also available to download. In addition to the materials that you see on the slide during the presentation, we have more information available in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded versions. Today's training is co-sponsored by the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. This training course was developed by the ITRC Radionuclides team and EPA's Superfund office. It discusses the methodology used to select remedies under EPA's approach for CERCLA sites. The focus of this training is guidance for remediating radioactively contaminated sites. In addition to CERCLA cleanup and its associated guidance, this course discusses long-term stewardship challenges related to large radioactively contaminated sites. If you move to slide two, using that orange right arrow, I'm going to briefly talk about ITRC. Overall, our goal is to help people make better decisions, and we do this through a network led by state regulators and including others in the environmental community. This diverse group works together on projects. Often the outcome of a project are documents and training like today's training. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States and includes state members in almost all states. If you're interested in learning more about ITRC, you're welcome to go to the ITRC website. We've listed that at the top of this page. You can also contact the ITRC state point of contact in your state, and that information is available on the ITRC website. ITRC's federal partners include Departments of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. On slide three, this is our disclaimer and copyright, and we include this information in all ITRC presentations. We ask that you read over this slide. In short, it says we've tried to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide four, you'll see the list of course topics planned for 2007. Along the left-hand side, you're going to see some popular courses that we've offered in previous years. And on the right, you'll see the list of new courses. More information is available at the ITRC website under Internet-based training. I've also included at the bottom of the slide a link to the training archive. ITRC has developed over 35 different training courses, and archives of those courses are available for you to listen to at any time. You can see the presentation and hear a recording of a previous training class. And that link will take you to the ITRC archive. On slide five, if you've joined after I got started, please review the logistical reminders along the left. In today's presentation, we're going to start with an introduction and overview, and then radiation regulatory background, and an overview of CERCLA requirements. About halfway through, we have a break for questions, and we do ask that you hold all of your questions until that designated question-answer break. In the second half, we'll talk about circular radiation guidance and tools, and the challenges of long-term management of radiation sites. At the end, we'll take you to some links to additional resources, including the feedback form, and we do ask that you fill out the feedback form. We do use that information and really value your input. And at the end, we'll have more time for questions. On slide 6, I'll introduce today's instructors. The ITRC radionuclides team is led by Carl Spring of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Robert Storms of the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation. Our first instructor today is Tom Snyder. Tom has worked for the Ohio EPA in the area of radioactive site remediation since 1990. He manages a team charged with implementing Ohio's oversight and environmental monitoring program at the U.S. Department of Energy Fresnel site. Carl Spring has worked for the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment since 1992. He is a project manager overseeing environmental restoration at DOE's Rocky Flat site. Robin Anderson has worked in the Superfund programs in the Office of Superfund and Technology Innovation since 1989 on issues related to remedy selection and compliance with applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements. Stuart Walker has been employed by US EPA since 1990. He works on issues regarding cleanup of contaminated sites. His primary area of responsibility includes serving as Superfund program's national lead on issues regarding radioactively contaminated circle sites. And Robin and Stuart, have you joined the call?
We're here.
Thank you. It's great to hear from you all. On slide 7, I am going to turn over today's call to our first instructor, Tom Snyder of the Ohio EPA. Tom?
Thanks, Juliana. First off, I wanted to provide a little background information on the radionuclides team, the group who developed the documents and training that we're going to be talking about today. The team was originally organized around DOE sites and focused on the work going on, the cleanup work going on at those sites, and was primarily made up of states who had DOE sites in them, and regulators and stakeholders, feds and contractors associated with those sites. We've had up to 9 states over the history of the site, the team, and currently have the 6 states listed above on the team. And we first started in the late 1990s. More recently, team members have joined with interest in non-DOE radionuclide sites, and in most cases, the technologies from these DOE experiences can be readily transferred to private sites and even to the potential cleanup after a dirty bomb scenario, so it is applicable to emergency and homeland response kind of activities as well. As Juliana said, Robert Storms from Tennessee and Carl Spring from Colorado are the current team leaders. We'll move on to slide 8 and talk about some of the team products. This slide lists the products that the team has produced since its start, and that includes 4 final documents, 3 internet trainings, 2 in addition to today's, one on radiation risk assessments and one on real-time characterization utilizing radiation detectors. And all of the documents and the training are available online in archive format. Ongoing work for the team includes focusing on D&D technologies, and we expect that a document will be produced later on at the end of this year addressing D&D technologies, and probably subsequently an internet-based training for that too as well for radionuclide sites. And like I said, all of those are available via links at the ITRC website, which is provided on the slide above. We'll move on to slide number 9 now, and a little discussion on the major federal laws on radiation protection. A number of laws relate specifically to the regulation of radionuclides and can affect the cleanup programs. Everything from classifying the waste to determining disposal and transportation requirements are addressed by various regulations. The impact of these various regulations on cleanup standards will be part of the discussion in Module 1 later on. Moving on to slide number 10, the laws that were listed previously on slide 9 generate a list of categories of radioactive materials. In addition to the more commonly referred to low-level and high-level waste designations, these are some of the other major categories. And it's important to note that it's not necessarily, these names don't necessarily relate to the relative concentrations or duration of risk of the actual radionuclide components. Most of the names relate to when and where the material was generated, not specifically its content. The radioactively contaminated sites that the ITRC radionuclides team is interested in is focused on historically or generally CERCLA sites. CERCLA is the broad umbrella regulation for cleanup of sites and can include relevant requirements for other regulations. This training is going to be focused on how CERCLA is applied to sites with radiological contamination. Moving on to slide number 11, what are we going to learn today? As you can see, we intend to cover a lot of territory today. The intent of the training is to allow state regulators and others to understand that cleanup numbers differ, and more importantly, why. In order to generate cleanup numbers, we'll help you understand the process and guidance in general terms and provide references to useful guidance and additional details that can be found. Finally, since most sites aren't cleaned up to free release levels, it's essential to understand the basic concepts and issues associated with long-term management of these sites. Don't expect to come away from this training as an expert in RAD CERCLA process. That takes a long time, many years, and you still doubt whether you can actually grasp all the various aspects of it. We hope to provide, though, a thorough overview of the process and provide a good set of resources that you can look back over time to help you along the way in working on these sites. Move on to slide number 12. This slide basically provides an overview of the modules we're going to talk about that are going to be covered today. Module 1 is going to focus on the cleanup document that we talked about. Modules 2 and 3 will cover the CERCLA process and really give a good US EPA perspective of how CERCLA should be implemented. And then finally, Module 4 is going to talk about that long-term management of sites that don't get cleaned up to free release levels. We expect that those of you participating in this training will have various backgrounds and levels of experience with risk assessment in general, and with radionuclides in particular. If there are terms or concepts that are unclear during this training, there are resources listed at the end of the training slides that should help. In addition, we have the question and answer periods to help provide clarification. And then finally, there's an archived version of this training available on the internet, as well as the documents that the course is based upon. Moving on to slide number 13. These next two slides, 13 and 14, provide a list of acronyms that will help you as we hardcore regulators continue to spew forth the acronyms, which I'm afraid is a habit we can't break. So we're going to provide you a list to try to keep up with us. But it's a simple fact of life that anytime you have multiple government agencies regulating another government agency, working with additional government agencies to produce a product, you're going to have a bunch of acronyms fly around. And so hopefully this list will help you keep up with as we accidentally continue to spill them out as we go through the training. We'll move on. So that's slide 13. Moving on to slide 14, and that's the last list of acronyms. I'm now going to hand you over to Carl Spring, a regulator with the state of Colorado who worked on the Rocky Flats site cleanup. If he still keeps working on it, though it has achieved cleanup. Carl will be discussing the findings of our cleanup document and setting the stage for further study on the processes and requirements of CERCLA cleanup. Carl?
Thanks, Tom. Now, module 1 begins with the next slide, slide 15. In this module, we'll be talking about specific sites where the regulations that Tom talked about in the introduction have been applied. By participating in this session, we want you to be able to, first of all, explain the variation in radiation standards due to differences in regulatory authorities, and also understand that variation in regulatory standards might require different approaches for developing cleanup levels and selecting remedies. Now, if you'll go with me to the next slide, 16. In 2002, the radionuclides team of the ITRC published a document titled Determining Cleanup Levels at Radioactively Contaminated Sites. And this document summarizes the various regulatory standards and requirements that dictate cleanup at sites contaminated with radionuclides. And it also presents case studies from 12 selected sites to demonstrate variation in how cleanup levels were set. Instructions for getting to a PDF copy of this document are in the notes below this slide. And if anyone wants a free hard copy sent to them, just contact one of today's instructors. By compiling this document, we were hoping site managers and state regulators could take advantage of experiences and lessons learned at other sites with similar contamination. The decision makers may find it useful to examine the basis of setting radiological cleanup levels and selecting remedies at these other sites. The purpose of this report is to examine the context in which these decisions have been made at various sites and to identify common themes and lessons that would improve future decision making. We felt that a common understanding among state and federal agencies, stakeholders, and site operators of how various cleanup levels have been arrived and remedies selected will make this whole process more efficient and more defensible and more consistent. Now, slide 17 shows a location map of the 12 selected sites that I mentioned. First of all, the Brookhaven National Lab in Long Island, New York, and the Weetok Atoll in Marshall Island, Western Pacific, the Fernald Project in southwestern Ohio, Fort Dixon, New Jersey, the Hanford site in southeastern Washington, Johnson Atoll in the Pacific, the Lindy site in upstate New York, Rocky Flats near Denver, the Nevada Test Site, Oak Ridge Reservation in Tennessee, Welland Spring near St. Charles, Missouri, and the Savannah River site in South Carolina. These sites don't represent a comprehensive list, but they do represent the variety in the nuclear weapons complex. Nuclear research, nuclear materials processing, weapons assembly, weapons testing, and accidents. These sites are also in various stages of remediation right now. If you go with me to slide 18, this slide is here to indicate that different regulatory authorities lead to different regulatory standards, which in turn have led to different methodologies for calculating cleanup goals. Differences between cleanup levels from site to site are due to variations in one or more of these elements in the cleanup level development process. That process begins with determining which regulatory authority applies. And these authorities include CERCLA, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's decommissioning requirements, Department of Energy orders, state radiation control regulations, and so on. Slide 19. Here's a list of elements in the cleanup level development process. Differences in these elements lead to differences in the resulting cleanup levels. The regulatory authority, which is what we just talked about, and the radiation standards applied either directly or as appropriate or applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, that is known by the acronym ARARS. Also differences in health assessment approaches, that is assessments of either risk or dose. Designated land uses or selected exposure scenarios may be different. Computer codes used may be different. And the parameters selected as inputs for the computer codes. The physical settings may vary considerably. The hydrogeology at Oak Ridge is vastly different than that at Rocky Flats, for example. And state and community acceptance. Now, that's a CERCLA modifying criteria, which you'll hear about in the next module. We found that local values and politics may have a great influence on the final values that are selected. And last, types of cleanup goals are reported. And I'll explain that further in a couple more slides. If you go to the next slide, 21, this slide and, or 20, this slide and slide 21 are a list of major U.S. radiation standards. And it's not a comprehensive list, but it shows most radiation standards. In addition to this list, most states have drinking water standards for radionuclides. And if they are more stringent than federal minimum contaminant levels, or MCLs, they are potentially relevant and appropriate requirements, or ARARs. You can see that most existing standards are expressed as annual dose limits in units of millirems per year. Others are expressed as activity per volume or mass per volume, or as working levels. In addition to accounting for any of these standards that might apply, CERCLA site decision makers must also consider risk, as shown on slide 21. On slide 22, here's a list of types of cleanup goals that were reported from the sites in the ITRC document. Preliminary remediation goals, ALARA cleanup levels, derived concentration guideline levels, allowable residual soil concentrations. These are actual terms used at the various sites in case studies. And you can see the cleanup numbers come in many varieties.
Okay.
It's important to understand the context and the intended use of the values. Otherwise, it's like comparing apples and oranges. Now, if you go to slide 23.
Slide 23.
Some case study sites have developed both risk-based and dose-based cleanup numbers in order to select a remedy that complies with CERCLA's risk range, as well as satisfying potential ARARs. An example from the ITRC cleanup levels document is shown here in slide 23. Oak Ridge used both approaches to calculate soil concentrations for the Melton Valley Record of Decision, using input parameters for each that were as equivalent as possible. The more conservative resulting value was then applied at the cleanup level for each radionuclide, as you can see in the last column. You can also see in the middle what's designated as an alternative concentration. That's based on an ARAR, and it was used for radium-226. That's interesting that neither approach seems to lead consistently to a more conservative value than the other. The cleanup levels document also shows that similarly at Rocky Flats, both dose-based and risk-based action levels were calculated, first back in 1996, then again in 2002. And both times, these two values were compared to decide which should apply as action levels. The reason two values were calculated and compared is explained in an upcoming slide. Slide 24. Selecting the appropriate future land use and exposure scenarios is a critical step in selecting appropriate remedies. Scenarios are descriptions of various lifestyles and activity patterns that approximate an individual's exposure to contaminants and environmental media. Generally speaking, cleanup that is based on a residential scenario, like a suburban resident, a rural resident, resident farmer or rancher, those types of scenarios will allow unrestricted use of a site. Choosing a less conservative scenario may invoke institutional controls and inherent long-term restrictions. Considerable difference in half-lives among various radionuclides is an important consideration in deciding whether long-term controls are feasible and therefore may affect the selection of exposure scenarios. Slide 25, all of the cleanup levels shown in this table, which is taken out of the ITRC document, are for plutonium-239-240. This table demonstrates that the risk assessment approach used at these different sites influences the amount of risk attributed to the different exposure pathways. The inhalation pathway, for instance, is the major exposure pathway in one case, but it's second or third in all the others. The plant ingestion pathway is minor in most cases, but it contributes most of the risk at Hanford, where the residential receptor was considered to eat relatively large amounts of homegrown fruits and vegetables. On slide 26, this table lists the soil concentrations calculated for plutonium-239-240 at the different sites, so that the variation from site to site can be shown. Now, plutonium is not the primary radioactive contaminated at several of these sites, but plutonium was picked so that we'd have a basis for making a comparison. As we said before, we can't directly compare these values without knowing the context for deriving them and applying them. A couple of upcoming slides show that which of these exposure scenarios were assessed by various sites. And they'll also show how cleanup levels at the same site vary depending on land use assumptions. A comparison of cleanup levels for residential versus commercial or industrial scenarios at sites where both were calculated shows that a residential scenario yields a cleanup level that is typically about 3 to 7 times more conservative. Now I'll talk just briefly about each one of these sites. First of all, Inuwetok. This is a nuclear weapons testing site in the Marshall Islands in the Western Pacific, from 1946 through 1958. And the data we used was from a Defense Nuclear Agency report written in 1981, and it presented four exposure scenarios, which represented what were considered various island uses. This report documented an 8-year cleanup effort beginning in 1972, involved 1,000 workers, and it cost $100 million plus the lives of 8 servicemen working on the project. In May of 2000, the Islanders were awarded $341 million in settlement, in part to complete the cleanup. Now, at Fernald in Ohio, these cleanup levels here were derived jointly by the Department of Energy, U.S. EPA, and the Ohio EPA. And they're based on a 10 to the minus 6 risk level to on-site receptors and a 10 to the minus 5 risk to off-site receptors. Now, DOE closure, this is a DOE closure site that has completed physical cleanup. And the primary radionuclide contamination here comes from uranium isotopes and radium. The remedy here was to treat uranium-contaminated groundwater and place low-level waste in on-site disposal cells, plus ship trainloads of contaminated Ohio soil out to Utah. For Dix, this is an U.S. Air Force site on an Army base, and it involved a 1960 missile accident, a Bomark missile, which is a nuclear-tipped anti-aircraft missile. There was a Department of Energy Record of Decision written in 1992 that established an 8 picocurie per gram cleanup level for plutonium. That's roughly equivalent to about 4 millirems per year. Now, in 2000, New Jersey promulgated soil remediation standards for radioactive materials, and the standard for plutonium calculates out to about 26 picocuries per gram, as you can see, and that's equivalent to about 15 millirems per year. And here the remedy was a little over a year-long project to remove contaminated soil, and again, train loads were shipped out to Utah for disposal. At Hanford, the numbers here come from the Washington Department of Health, and they're based on a 15 millirem per year value. The PRGs, that is preliminary remediation goals, were calculated back in 1995, used the ResRad computer code. These aren't final cleanup numbers that were calculated back then, but they're preliminary remediation goals. The final remedy for rad-contaminated soils and groundwater has not yet been selected. The Johnson Atoll, this is the site of an explosion during a nuclear test. It lies about 800 miles southwest of Hawaii. And there were actually 3 nuclear rocket mishaps back in the 1960s. 2 exploded up in the atmosphere, and 1 exploded on the launch pad. A 13.5 picocurie per gram level was established as an ALARA cleanup level, that is, as low as reasonably achievable. And that level was established by EPA Region 9. It's equivalent to about 7 times 10 to the minus 6 residential risk. The values calculated in 2000 were shown here, and they're recommended in a Defense Threat Reduction Agency report, which again used the ResRad computer code to calculate values equivalent to the circular risk range. The remedy here was to excavate and remove the more highly radioactive soils. And the low-level radioactive soil has been placed under a coral debris cap. The land use here was designated as a national wildlife refuge. Now, if you go to the next 2 slides, first of all, 27, these 2 slides have views of the Fernald Environmental Management Project. And this first slide is a view looking east across waste pit number 5 during excavation. The red uranium oxide pit sludge is visible in the foreground. And the on-site disposal facility is visible off in the background. Next slide is also Fernald, slide 28. And this is taken from the top of the on-site disposal facility, looking west over the former production area. The rail yard used to haul soil off to Utah is to the right in this picture, and waste pits and silos remediation facilities are in the background. And the next slide is a picture of Hanford, an aerial view, which where you can see the Columbia River off in the lower right-hand corner. And it's the area of the D and the DR reactors. The next slide, 30, is of Johnson Island. This is a picture of the Thor missile. This is the one that exploded on the launch pad during a test here in the Johnson Atoll. The next slide, 31, is a continuation of that lists some more sites that we looked at in this document. First of all, the Lawrence Livermore National Lab in California. These values were actually calculated for an off-site park, the Big Trees Park, and EPA Region 9 established these as soil screening levels and were calculated back in 1998. So these aren't actual cleanup numbers, but soil screening levels. The next site, Rocky Flats, these were established in 1996, part of the first cleanup agreement. And as a state regulator, I was part of the working group that developed these action levels. They're based on a 15 milligram annual dose limit. And that was based on what at the time was draft Part 196 regulations. And those draft Part 196 has now been withdrawn. When those were calculated, they were compared with the existing risk-based TRGs to decide which should apply as action levels. We used the ResRad computer code to calculate these. Now, in the year 2000, the TRGs, which are 10 to the minus 6 risk-based values, those were updated using new cancer slope factors, and we added the wildlife refuge worker scenario following the enactment of the Rocky Flats Wildlife Refuge Act. So that act established this new future land use, and so we added that wildlife refuge worker scenario. Then 2 years later, in 2002, I was part of a new working group to recalculate the action levels. Here, refuge worker and residential action levels were derived from probabilistic risk calculations. A 10 to the minus 5th risk level using the 95th percentile of the risk distribution. The calculated value for the wildlife refuge worker action level is 11 picocuries per gram, but the actual, 116, as it's shown there, 116 picocuries per gram, but the actual action level was established at 50 picocuries per gram, and that's a negotiated level. It's well below, as you can see, well below the calculated value. The office worker and open space user action levels correspond to point estimates of a 10 to the minus 5th risk. Now, these risk-based action levels were compared to and again found to be more conservative than the ResRad calculated 25 millirem per year levels. Those dose-based levels, the 25 millirem per year levels, those were derived in order to satisfy the state's decommissioning criteria, which were deemed to be relevant and appropriate requirements. So again, both dose-based and risk-based values were calculated, and the more conservative one selected. During this whole process, there was considerable public stakeholder participation and scrutiny, including a formal oversight panel and a stakeholder-hired peer review team. The remedy here has been to excavate radioactively contaminated soils, concentrating on the upper 3 feet, and off-site disposal. Truckloads of Colorado soil has ended up in disposal sites in Utah as well as New Mexico, Nevada, and up in Washington until a court order put a stop to that. Some subsurface contamination, including in some building basements, was left in place. The conclusion we came to from examining these various example sites was that these calculated plutonium values cannot be directly compared without knowing context for each. Some of them are dose-based, some are risk-based. They're calculated for different risk or dose levels, and they're protective of different exposure scenarios. Now, the next three slides are scenes from Rocky Flats. First of all, slide 32, this is a view of Rocky Flats as it once looked, looking northwest with the Front Range in the near background and the Indian Peaks Wilderness off in the far background. This is one of DOE's closure sites, like Fernald, and it was scheduled to close by the end of 2006, but the physical completion actually occurred over a year earlier. And all of the hundreds of structures in this picture, which is about 10 years old, they've all been taken down, and the site's returning to its original tall grass prairie state. In addition, many environmental restoration projects have been completed. For example, you can see an L-shaped white tent in the lower end of the industrial area in the center. That's was established there, set up to cover the remediation of a trench that was filled with barrels of uranium shavings. You can also see evaporation ponds above there that were remediated a few years ago. And the gray square to the left of that white L-shaped tent, that's the infamous 903 pad, which is the source of wind-scattered plutonium, and that's also been cleaned up. The next slide, 33. This is inside a tent, one of two large tents that were dragged around from site to site around the 903 pad, and the cleanup also included a large area of the wind-blown contamination off of the pad. The next slide, 34. Decontamination, decommissioning of buildings was a major accomplishment in Rocky Flats. One of the buildings, Building 771, was once described as the most contaminated building in the country, and that's now been decontaminated and demolished. At other buildings, explosives were used to collapse decontaminated floors into sub-basements. On slide 35, lists some of the conclusions that we drew from the observations made in the ITRC document. First of all, the overall conclusion of the cleanup levels document was determining cleanup levels and selecting remedies can involve complex and emotional issues, from actual cost to social cost, net benefit to stakeholders, land values, environmental detriment, and so forth. At each site, special circumstances exist, and each cleanup action should be evaluated on its own merits. Next, cleanup numbers used at one site should not be used to justify similar cleanup numbers at another site. And next, risk assessment and risk management are different. And the next slide has some other pertinent conclusions, and they include it's a good idea to achieve consistency within given risk assessment approaches. The EPA's PRG calculator for radionuclides is one available tool that you'll hear about later in this training. Next, land use assumptions are important. They can impact cleanup levels, remedy selection, and long-term stewardship. And last, we concluded that training would help lend consistency to assessment of risks. And today's training is a direct result from that conclusion. Now that concludes Module 1. This module has explained how radioactively contaminated sites have developed cleanup level frameworks in the past using guidance that existed at the time. This sets the stage for the following modules, which will explain current guidance for cleanup at these sites. New guidance over the years has made my job as a regulator more efficient by standardizing certain pieces of the process and by providing updates of important exposure parameters, slope factors, and so on. So I'd now like to introduce Robin Anderson of the EPA, who will present Module 2. Robin?
Thank you, Carl. In this module, we hope you gain a better understanding of the Superfund remedy selection process. This module provides information on setting cleanup goals and remedy selection that provides the rationale for many of the cleanup decisions discussed by Carl in the preceding module. We will also be discussing the Superfund process for listing sites on the National Priorities List. Unlike the case studies discussed by Carl in Module 1, I'll be presenting training on EPA's regulatory requirements and national policies in this module. Given that this talk is about compliance with regulations, statutes, and guidance, it's very important that the information is presented in a factual, precise manner. Therefore, the pace and the delivery of this and the next module are different from other portions of this training. Turning to page 38, the EPA cleans up site contamination under the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, otherwise known as CERCLA or Superfund. The National Oil and Hazardous Substances Pollution Contingency Plan, or the NCP for short, is implementing regulation. The NCP contains both procedures and standards for the Superfund program. Another of the key components of the Superfund program is the National Priorities List, or NPL. This is a list of sites with known or threatened releases of hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants. NPL sites are often what many people refer to as Superfund sites. However, many non-NPL sites are also addressed under CERCLA authority. Turning to page 39. The focus of this module is how radiation is addressed by the Superfund program. The module provides general information on standards and procedures used by the Superfund program. I should note here that radionuclides are chemicals that emit radiation. However, for purposes of this training, the term chemicals will only refer to non-radioactive contamination, since this is the terminology which most listeners are familiar. Within the Superfund remediation framework, radioactive contamination is dealt with in a manner that is consistent with how chemical contamination is addressed, except to account for any technical differences between radionuclides and chemicals. This consistency is referred to by EPA as risk harmonization between radionuclide and chemical site cleanup. Consistency is very important since at every radioactively contaminated site being addressed on Superfund's National Priorities List, chemical contamination is also present. Let's turn to page 40. There are two types of cleanup actions taken under CERCLA authority, known as...
I'm not sure who we're going to be mailing those to. I thought you...
I were picking up some background noise, so if you are currently speaking, please be sure that your phone is on mute, and that is *6 to mute. Sorry about that, Robin.
Thank you. So there's two types of cleanup actions undertaken under CERCLA.
I'm going to be tied up before 15 again.
They're either known as removal or remedial response actions. Removal actions address the more immediate threat to public health than the environment. And there are three types of these. The emergency removals are those that require response be initiated within minutes or hours. Time-critical removals are those where it's determined that a response action is needed to be initiated in less than 6 months. And time-critical removals occur when it's determined that a response action may be initiated in more than 6 months. Remedial actions, on the other hand, tend to be more long-term responses at complex and highly contaminated sites. These sites will often require several years of study to understand the scope and extent of risk and potential remedies before deciding upon a permanent remedy. Emergency and time-critical removals may be taken during this time to address immediate threats and concerns. Turning to page 41. Here you see a picture of a holding basin at the nuclear metal site in Concord, Massachusetts. This is the example of a removal action site that also happens to be on the National Priorities List. Contaminants at the site included depleted uranium and other inorganic compounds. This portion of the removal action involved capping of the holding basin. In the future, remedial actions will address the other concerns at the site. turn to page 42. On this slide is another example of a removal action. Here you see four pictures related to removal actions at the abandoned uranium mine site at the Navajo Nation. This site is not on the national priorities list. Under the Navajo Abandoned Uranium Mines Project, EPA, Navajo Nation EPA, and the Army Corps of Engineers have worked together to identify mining areas that pose a hazard, develop and implement follow-up investigations and action plans under various regulatory authorities, including CERCLA, and have taken some emergency removal actions where appropriate. This project survey identified over 1,000 abandoned mines and mine features in Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. An aerial survey of 41 mining areas covered approximately 1,144 square miles. Turn to page 43. On this slide, you'll see a listing of steps in the remedial process. We will briefly go over this process. The preliminary assessment site inspection, or TSI phase, is when EPA initially begins to investigate a site to see if EPA should take action, and if so, whether the site should be addressed by the remedial removal program. The Hazard Ranking System, or HRS, is a scoring methodology that's used to screen sites to determine whether or not they should be placed on the national priority list. Sites that score high enough on the hazard ranking score may undergo a national priorities listing process that includes public comment. We'll discuss the HRS scoring and the NPL listing process in more details in the next four slides. Sites that are listed on the national priorities list will undergo a remedial investigation and feasibility study, or RIFS, to determine the nature and extent of contamination. When EPA decides on a cleanup approach, a remedial decision, or ROD, will be issued that explains which of the cleanup alternatives that was considered was chosen. Previous to signing the ROD, the public will have an opportunity to comment on EPA's preferred alternative in a proposed plan. After the ROD, the remedial design and remedial action phase involves the preparation and implementation of plans and specifications for applying the remedies. Construction completion refers to completion of any construction required for the cleanup. One common example of when a site achieves construction completion is if the soil contamination has been removed and a groundwater pump and treat system set up, which is then expected to operate for a number of years. Post-construction completion ensures that the Superfund response action provides for the long-term protection of human health and the environment. Included here are long-term response actions, operation and maintenance, institutional controls, five-year reviews, remedy optimization, and finally, national priority list deletion. Turning to page 44. Sites may be listed on the national priorities list using one of the following three methods. First, through the scoring using the HRS, which I will discuss in more detail later. Second, each state was able to designate one release as a top priority for listing. Almost every state has already used their one pick for this category. Third, if the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, or the ATSDR, has issued a health advisory for the release and EPA determines that the release poses a significant threat to public health and that it would be more cost effective to respond by listing the site on the national priorities list rather than taking a removal action. Turn to page 45. The site assessment process includes four primary screening activities: pre-CERCLA screening, preliminary assessment, site inspection, and finally HRS scoring. At the conclusion of each phase of the site assessment process, EPA generally applies the Hazard Ranking System model to derive a preliminary site score. In general, sites generating a score of 28.5 or greater can be proposed to the National Priorities List. In the HRS scoring process, scores with the highest potential for National Priority listing will result from the following. First, instances where people are currently exposed to contamination rather than the potential for future exposure. Second, if releases are observed, particularly above HRS benchmarks. And third, if bioaccumulation is occurring in the food chain or a sensitive environment. Turn to page 46. Benchmarks used in the hazard ranking scoring process include the following: cancer risk, reference concentrations for non-carcinogen, maximum contaminant level drinking water standards when looking at contaminants in groundwater, and several other federal standards, including soil standards for radium issued under the Uranium Mill Tailings Radiation Control Act, or UMTRCA. One activity that is not, I repeat, not done during the hazard ranking system scoring is a dose assessment to determine millirem levels. Turn to page 47. Listing a site on the NPL is a rulemaking process that uses the hazard ranking system scores. If EPA makes a decision to pursue a listing a site on the NPL, the proposed listing will appear in the Federal Register. To propose a site based on the HRS score, a detailed and defensible scoring package must be prepared that includes all the information collected during the site assessment process. Once a site is proposed to the National Priorities List in the Federal Register, all interested parties may submit comments on the proposed listing and the HRS score. Sometimes the HRS score will change based on the public comment. In addition, since 1995, EPA has a policy of not listing sites on the National Priorities List without a letter of concurrence on behalf of the governor of the state in which the site is located. After EPA finalizes listing a site on the National Priorities List, stakeholders other than federal agencies may file a legal challenge. Turning to page 48, I want to start talking a little about how cleanup decisions are made under CERCLA. Cleanup decisions under CERCLA are made site-specifically and must comply with both the statute and its implementing regulation, the NCP. Site cleanup decisions are made by whichever of EPA's 10 regions the site is based. EPA has two kinds of site managers. On-scene coordinators, or OSCs, are generally EPA's managers for emergency and time-critical removals. Remedial project managers, or RPMs, generally manage the remedial and non-time-critical removal actions. The rest of my talk will focus on the remedial program. Turning to page 49. The NCP establishes 9 remedy evaluation criteria for selecting a response for CERCLA site. The 9 criteria fall within the following categories: threshold, balancing, and modifying. First, the threshold criteria. CERCLA requires that all remedial actions at Superfund sites must be protective of human health and the environment. CERCLA also requires that remedial actions either attain or waive what is known as applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, or ARARs. ARARs are standards and requirements found in state and federal environmental laws and regulations other than CERCLA and the NCP. Applicable requirements are those that would have to be met without the site being cleaned up under CERCLA or not. Relevant and appropriate requirements are those that are sufficiently similar to the situation being addressed at a CERCLA site that the substantive portions of their requirements must be met or waived at the CERCLA site. One very common usage of ARARs involves protection of groundwater. Site cleanups should protect groundwaters that are current or potential sources of drinking water to the drinking water standards whenever practicable. These drinking water standards include federal maximum contaminant levels, or MCLs, promulgated under the Safe Drinking Water Act and the state drinking water standards. At CERCLA sites, these drinking water standards as ARRs are generally met throughout the plume. Turning to page 50. After eliminating some remedial actions for not meeting the threshold criteria discussed previously, all remaining ones under consideration should be protective of human health and the environment and comply with ARRs. The next type of criteria are the balancing and modifying criteria. The five balancing criteria are used to identify major trade-offs between remedial alternatives. The criteria balance the following. 1. Long-term effectiveness and permanence, which is the ability of the remedy to provide protectiveness over time. 2. Reduction of toxicity, mobility, or volume through treatment, which is the anticipated performance of the treatment technologies that a remedy may employ. 3. Short-term effectiveness, which addresses how long before the remedy is completed and any adverse effects that may result from implementing the remedy. 4. Implementability, which is the technical and administrative feasibility of the remedy. And 5. Cost, which includes capital and operation and maintenance costs and net present worth cost. Turning to page 51. The last type of criteria are the modifying criteria. There are two modifying criteria, state acceptance and community acceptance, and these may not be considered fully until after public comment has been received on EPA's preferred remedial alternative. These first two criteria are called modifying criteria because new information or comments from the state or community may modify the preferred remedial alternative or cause another alternative to be considered. However, EPA has found that to have a successful site cleanup, the state and the community must have the opportunity for meaningful involvement from the early stages of site cleanup process. Turning to page 52, let's go over some of the important features of addressing radioactive contamination under CERCLA. First, EPA considers all radionuclides to be Class A carcinogens, which means known to cause cancer in humans. At Superfund radiation sites, EPA generally evaluates potential human health risk based on the cancer risk only for each radionuclide present. However, for uranium in soluble form, non-cancer effects are considered as well as the cancer risk at Superfund sites. As mentioned previously, within the Superfund remediation framework, radionuclide contamination is dealt with in a consistent manner as with chemical contamination, except to account for the technical differences between radionuclides and chemicals. Risk from radionuclide exposure are estimated in a similar manner to that used for chemical contaminants. Radionuclide risk assessment also typically includes risk from gamma radiation and produce consumption, but not dermal exposure. Turning to page 53, EPA uses a consistent process for setting cleanup levels. ARRs, applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, discussed previously, are often the determining factor in establishing cleanup levels at CERCLA sites. When these are not either available or considered sufficiently protective, EPA sets site-specific cleanup numbers based on risk for carcinogen and non-carcinogenic risk. For carcinogens such as radionuclides, EPA uses a 10 to the minus 4th to 10 to the minus 6th cancer risk range, which can be interpreted to mean that a highly exposed individual may have a 1 in 10,000 to a 1 in 1 million increased chance of developing cancer because of exposure to site-related carcinogens. 10 to the minus 6th is used as the point of departure for determining cleanup goals, and when deciding to take response actions, EPA generally prefers cleanup at the most protective end, the 10 to the minus 6 end, of the risk range. For cleanups based on cancer risk, the EPA establishes preliminary remediation goals, PRGs, at 1 × 10⁻⁶. PRGs are identified early in the CERCLA process. They may be used as initial cleanup goals if applicable, but they are not defective cleanup standards and should not be applied as such. Site-specific remediation alternatives are evaluating using all 9 of the NCP remedy selection criteria. Although the upper end of the risk range is not set in stone at 1 × 10⁻⁴, EPA generally uses 1 × 10⁻⁴, although a slightly higher risk estimate may be justified based on site-specific circumstances. To assess the potential for cumulative non-carcinogenic effects posed by multiple contaminants, EPA has developed a hazard index, or HI. The HI is derived by adding the non-cancer risk for site contaminants with the same target organ or mechanism of toxicity. When the HI exceeds 1, there may be concern for adverse health effects due to exposure to multiple contaminants. EPA also addresses ecological concerns when selecting cleanup levels. In addition, EPA sometimes uses to-be-considered materials, or TBCs, to help in carrying out or determining the level of protectiveness of selected remedies. TBCs are criteria, advisory, guidance, and proposed standards that are not legally enforceable, but contain information that would be useful for cleaning up a particular site. Turning to page 54. I'd like to take a little bit of time to talk to you about what CERCLA cleanup levels are not based upon. This is very important to note, since many people outside of EPA Superfund program that are addressing radioactive contamination use an entirely different risk management framework. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC, has a rule for decommissioning NRC licensees that sets an allowable cleanup level of 25 millirem per year effective dose equivalent, or EDE, as the primary standard, with exemptions allowed allowing dose limits up to 100 millirem per year EDE. EPA has determined that the dose limits in this rule should not be used to establish preliminary remediation goals under CERCLA. If this NRC rule is considered to be an error at a site, then the 10⁻⁶ point of departure is still used, and the 10⁻⁴ to 10⁻⁶ range must still be met. Also, there are a lot of dose-based recommendations expressed in terms of millirem per year that have been issued by NRC, the Department of Energy, and international or national organizations such as the International Commission on Radiological Protection and the National Council on Radiation Protection and Measurement. However, CERCLA site decision makers should not use these millirem per year guidance recommendations rather than the CERCLA risk range in developing cleanup levels. This is because, for several reasons, using dose-based guidance would result in unnecessary inconsistency regarding how radiological and chemical contaminants are addressed at CERCLA sites. These reasons include: estimates of risk from a given dose estimate may vary by an order of magnitude or more for a particular radionuclide, and dose-based guidance generally begins an analysis for determining a site-specific cleanup level at a minimally acceptable level rather than the 10⁻⁶ point of departure. Turning to page 55, this concludes Module 2, our overview of the CERCLA process. Hopefully, this module has helped you to understand that radionuclides are treated like other contamination under CERCLA. CERCLA has a consistent process for addressing radionuclides. In particular, CERCLA decisions are based primarily on risk and standards, such as MCLs as ARRs, rather than based on millirem per year standards like those issued by the NRC. As a result, cleanup levels established using the CERCLA process can be expected to vary from site to site. We will now move to the question and answer session on slide 55. Following that, Stuart Walker will discuss the various guidance documents and tools available to aid and remedy decisions under CERCLA. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. We're now on the question and answer slide. It's actually 56. And we do want to take a break now to get questions from our audience. If you're in the simulcast audience, it's that orange question mark button at the top of the slide that will allow you to send in a question. For our phone line audience, you're welcome to ask your own questions out loud. Remember to unmute your phone, and to do that using our system, that is *7 to unmute. And we ask that you state your name and location when asking a question. Would someone from the phone line like to start? I have a simulcast question from Michael Stowe at the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services in Concord. I believe that the 28.5 HRS cutoff score was left over from prioritizing the original 100 Superfund sites in 1980, i.e., it was the 50 percentile score of the original 100 sites using the original HRS system. Is there any talk of changing the HRS score cutoff for RAD sites?
Yeah, this is Stuart. No, we haven't discussed changing the cutoff for RAD sites or chemical sites. There were changes to the HRS a while back to make the scoring more based on exposure to actual receptors rather than potential receptors, but there hasn't been any discussion of changing HRS in years.
Thank you. Any questions from our phone line audience? The ITRC RADS team has also developed a training class on real-time measurement of radionuclides in soil. Carl or Tom, could you tell us a little bit about what information is covered in that training class?
It's based, again, on a document that I believe was mentioned earlier, and it covers mostly how real-time instruments are used to characterize RAD cleanup sites, and discusses some of the technologies for those, and then again has case studies where those technologies, those various real-time measurement technologies have been used. And as you mentioned, a training has been developed and has been given, I believe, a couple times on that on that document.
That training is available in the ITRC archives. We're also going to offer it again in September. On September 20th is the schedule, and registration will open in August. From Kelly at ENSR in Connecticut, in a risk assessment including both radionuclides and chemicals, are potential carcinogenic risks from radionuclides and non-radionuclides added together for cumulative risk, or are chemicals and radionuclide risk treated separately?
This is Stuart. They're calculated separately, then they're added together. This is that guidance goes, I think that was originally part of RAGS Part A, probably about 1990, but yeah, that's our current guidance too. Might also point out, Stuart, that that's talked about a lot more detail on the RAD risk assessment training. I'm not sure when that's back up again on the queue. Do you know, Juliana?
We don't have that one planned again for this year.
For this year? Okay. There
right.
is a archived version of the RAD risk assessment training available on the website, though, and would cover that in a lot more detail.
Yes, yes, definitely. Thanks, Tom.
The RAD team is also, I'm sorry, go ahead, do you have a question?
A question from Amy Rosenstein of ICF. One of the case studies, the Oak Ridge one, shows that the criteria for selection of the cleanup levels were both risk and dose, as well as AROR. And the most recent presenter stated that the CERCLA site, it needs to be dependent just upon risk. Is that going forward? from now, or just wondering how that Oak Ridge case study shows that there's a mixture of risk and dose for the cleanup level, whether that would still apply now.
I can answer that. We have to state that very carefully when we come to that, those slides that cover that. I believe that's slide 23. He was correct what Robin stated, that at CERCLA sites, the cleanup decision has to be within the CERCLA risk range. Now, those sites, and I mentioned two, Oak Ridge and Rocky Flats, also calculated dose-based numbers to ensure that those dose-based requirements that were considered ARARs were also considered. In the case of Oak Ridge, some of those ARARs were actually lower than the risk-based number, so they were applied. They resulted in a lower number. That put them that still validated and still considered the CERCLA risk range. They still that still applies. At Rocky Flats, the calculations done there, all of the dose-based numbers were outside the CERCLA risk range, and so weren't considered. They were so when both were calculated at a CERCLA site, they have to ensure that the final cleanup numbers are within the CERCLA risk range.
Yeah. I mean, you still have to meet the ARAR, and sometimes the dose-based ARAR will still fall within the risk range. But if the dose base standard is greater than 15 or millar, or 25 millar, then you need to do a PRG at 10 to minus 6. You still need to meet, so you're then just meeting two different regulatory approaches.
I have a simulcast question that refers to slide 19. So along the left, if you're using the Cluin system, there's a list of slide numbers, and you can jump to slide 19. This is from Ed Hanlon at EPA headquarters. Do you have examples of how changes in computer codes develop differences in cleanup goals?
Well, the two that I just cited, an example of Rocky Flats, the risk-based numbers were calculated using actually a large spreadsheet, and the computer code for the ResRad computer code was used to calculate the dose-based numbers, the millirems per year, and they resulted due to some variances in the way they are calculated. They result even if you use ResRad to calculate a risk-based number, you get slightly different answers than using a spreadsheet. And there's a long list of other computer codes too that are available.
From Lisa Ledgewood at IEER in Minneapolis, RAD and non-RAD risks are added together, as addressed earlier. But what about chemicals that act with radiation in a greater than additive way? Is there talk of taking synergistic health effects into account?
This is Stuart. We've had discussions on this internally, and at this point, people do not believe that we can adequately address synergistic or antagonistic effects between RAD and chemicals or different radionuclides. So, no, it's just a straight line additive process. At some point, if we feel we have better science and can quantify some of the effects, whether synergistic or otherwise, then we would do so.
Thank you, and thank you to everyone for participating in this question and answer break. We are going to go ahead and wrap up this question and answer break. We'll have another at the end. If you've taken your phone off of mute, and even if you haven't, please double check to be sure that your phone is on mute. And if you're using our system, it is *6 to mute your phone. If you go to slide 57, I'll now turn over today's presentation to Stuart Walker at the US EPA. Stuart.
Thanks, Juliana. We hope that Module 3 will help today's participants learn how to use EPA's guidance documents and tools appropriately at a radioactively contaminated CERCLA site. As with Module 2 that was presented by Robin, in Module 3 I'm going to be providing training on EPA's national policies on how radioactive contamination should be addressed at Superfund sites. So just like Robin in the last module, I'm going to be very precise with my wording this module so that you'll be better informed as to how EPA wants Superfund to be implemented at radioactively contaminated sites. Let's turn to slide 58. Sorry about that. This module will provide a brief overview of current guidance documents and electronic tools that were developed by EPA for addressing radioactively contaminated Superfund sites. Module 3 is thus building on the discussion in the last module about complying with CERCLA and NCP requirements by providing more specific information about EPA's policy recommendations for how to comply with those requirements. I will take the opportunity here to again note that within the Superfund remediation framework, radioactive contamination is dealt with in a manner that is consistent with how chemical contamination is addressed, except to account for the technical differences between radionuclides and chemicals. It is also important that users stay abreast of new guidance documents and tools issued by EPA by continuing to check EPA's Superfund Radiation and Remedy Decisions web pages. The Superfund Radiation web page focuses on guidance specifically to address radionuclides, including those discussed in this module, while the Remedy Decisions web page includes guidance used to select cleanup approaches at all types of CERCLA sites. Most important on these web pages are OSWR directives, which are EPA's official guidance for addressing CERCLA sites. This module will cover the key OSWR directives for addressing radioactive contamination. I'd also like to note here that the Superfund Radiation webpage also includes several EPA guidance that are not OSWR directives, which I'll not be covering. Although these non-OSWR documents do not represent EPA's recommended approach, site decision makers may find them useful. Okay, let's move on to page 59. One of EPA's key overarching guidance documents for addressing RAD sites is entitled Establishment of Cleanup Levels for CERCLA Sites with Radioactive Contamination. This memorandum provides guidance for establishing protective cleanup levels for radioactive contamination at CERCLA sites. In particular, this memo clarifies that first, cleanups of radionuclides are governed by the same 10⁴ to 10⁶ risk range established in the NCP for all carcinogens when ARRs are not available or not sufficiently protective. It includes a determination that dose limits of 25 and 100 mm per year EDE and NRC's decommissioning rule should generally not be used to establish cleanup levels under CERCLA. Second, response actions for contaminated groundwaters at radiation sites must comply with MCLs as ARRs when groundwaters are potential or current sources of drinking water. When determined to be an ARR, concentrations corresponding to MCL should generally be attained throughout the plume in the aquifer. Third, cleanup level should be developed considering the reasonably anticipated land use. Now let's move on to slide 60. For the next three slides, I'm going to briefly list some of the standards addressing radionuclides. They're among those more commonly determined to be ARRs at radioactively contaminated sites. Determination of whether or not any of these standards is an ARR in any particular site must be made site-specifically, looking at the circumstances of the site and the potential ARR. This slide covers three standards issued under UMTRCA. First, standards for soil contaminated with radium-226 or 228 were established at 5 picocuries per gram in excess of background as a protective health base level for the cleanup of the top 15 centimeters of soil. The standard is also often used in an ARR for soil contaminated with thorium-230 and 232. For indoor radon, the levels of radon-220 and 222 and their decay product concentrations, including background, are not to exceed 0.02 working levels. For outdoor radon, UMTRCA and the Clean Air Act established an average release rate of 20 picocuries per square meter per second of radon-222. Let's move on to page 61. NRC issued disposal standards for low-level waste with allowable exposure to the public of 25 mm to the whole body, 75 mm to thyroid, and 25 mm to any critical organ other than a thyroid. You should understand that this disposal standard uses an entirely different dose methodology than NRC's 25 and 100 mm per year EDE decommissioning standard. The dose limits in this disposal standard may be used to establish PRGs when it's determined to be an ARAR. Okay, let's move on to slide 62. For groundwaters and surface waters that are current or potential sources of drinking water, then federal MCLs are ARARs. Also, most states have their own drinking water standards, which, if more stringent than federal MCLs, are ARARs. There are four federal MCLs that address radionuclides. These are as follows. 5 picocuries per liter of radium-226 and 228 combined, 4 millirem per year from beta particles and photon emitters to the whole body or any internal organ, 15 picocuries per liter for gross alpha particle activity, which excludes radon and uranium, and 30 micrograms per liter of total uranium. Now, the uranium standard is based on the non-cancer effects of uranium as a kidney toxin. Under UMTRCA, a groundwater protection standard would establish a 30 picocuries per liter of uranium-234 and 238 combined. Almost every state has issued water quality standards for surface water that address radionuclides. Now let's turn to page 63. Now the first guidance document on interpreting a particular standard as an ARAR that I would like to discuss is entitled Use of Soil Cleanup Criteria in 40 CFR Part 182 as Remediation Goals for CERCLA Sites. This memo provides guidance regarding the circumstances under which the subsurface cleanup criteria in UMTRCA regulation should be considered an ARAR. For uranium mill tailing sites, EPA has established 5 picocuries per gram of radium as a protective health base level for the cleanup of the top 15 centimeters of soil, and 15 picocuries per gram of radium as a finding tool for locating and remediating discrete deposits of high-activity tailings. One key to interpreting the standards in ARAR correctly is to understand the finding tool concept. 15 picocuries per gram was determined to be adequate as a finding tool because subsurface contamination on UMTRCA sites was found to be highly concentrated, between 300 and 1,000 picocuries per gram. During the rulemaking, EPA analyzed several different subsurface levels as options. The agency estimated that because of the higher contamination levels in the subsurface, the same amount of cleanup would occur if the standard was set at 5 or 30 picocuries per gram. EPA decided that setting a level of 15 picocuries per gram would allow for more measurements out in the field on-site rather than lab measurements. This would result in cost savings while still achieving the same level of protection at UMTRCA sites as the 5 picocuries per gram standard. This finding is why the Superfund guidance recommends that the 15 finding tool is relevant and appropriate only when there is no significant subsurface contamination between 5 and 30 picocuries per gram, and the 15 finding tool will thus achieve a cleanup level of 5 or lower. Okay, let's move on to page 64. Here you see a picture of remedial action being conducted at the Welsbach MPL site in New Jersey. The primary contaminants at this site are thorium-232 and its daughters, which resulted from production of gas metals from the late 1890s to 1940 in Camden and Gloucester City, New Jersey. The site used the UMTRCA soil standard as an ARAR to help establish cleanup levels for the site. The guidance concerning 40 CFR 192, which was discussed on the previous slide, facilitated the establishment of these soil cleanup levels by providing clear direction on interpretation of the ARAR. Okay, let's move on to page 65. A closely related ARAR guidance to the UMTRCA soil guidance is one entitled Remediation Goals for Radioactively Contaminated CERCLA Sites Using the Benchmark Dose Cleanup Criteria in 10 CFR Part 40 Appendix AI Criterion 6.6. Now, we know that's quite a mouthful, so at EPA we usually just refer to this as the 6.6 guide. This memo provides guidance regarding when the 6.6 standard should be considered a potential ARAR for sites with radium-226 and 228, thorium-230 and 232, and uranium-234 and 238. Criterion 6.6 requires that an estimate be made of the level of radiation, called a benchmark dose, that an individual will receive after that site has been cleaned up to 5 picocuries per gram of radium. The millirem level of the benchmark dose then becomes the maximum level of radiation, what EPA refers to as a compliance dose, that an individual may be exposed to from all radionuclides, except radon, in both the soil and buildings at the site. Okay, let's move on to page 66. The 6-6 rule was developed to supplement the UMTRIA radium standard by addressing other site-related radionuclides. So, if the 5 and 15 picogary per gram UMTRIA standards are not relevant and appropriate requirements for either radium-226 or 228, then the criterion 6-6 rule is generally not appropriate. For the 6-6 rule to set cleanup levels under CERCLA, then a site-specific risk and dose assessment should show that the benchmark dose should be less than 15 mm per year, and the compliance concentration should meet the 10^4 to 10^6 cancer risk range, and an HI1 for non-carcinogenic effects of uranium. These dose and risk assessments should be conducted using EPA CERCLA methods, not NRCs. Okay, let's move on to page 67. When ARRs are not available or sufficiently protective, CERCLA cleanup levels are based on risk, not millirem. When developing risk estimates at Superfund sites, EPA uses slope factors and the health effects assessment tables known as HEAST instead of dose conversion factors. HEAST has been updated with new information from Federal Guidance 13 as based on information ICRP 72, which includes the latest information on radiation health effects from this international source. EPA's Superfund program is one of the few federal U.S. programs that I'm aware of that uses this current science as its primary basis for making risk management decisions. Okay, let's move on to page 68. EPA developed a fact sheet to provide an overview of current EPA guidance for risk assessment and related topics for radioactively contaminated CERCLA sites. It is entitled Radiation Risk Assessment at CERCLA Sites, Q&A. This fact sheet was primarily written for persons familiar with the Superfund process but not radiation. It provides answers to several commonly asked questions regarding risk assessments at radioactively contaminated CERCLA sites. This fact sheet provided new guidance on three topics. One, dose assessments should only be conducted under CERCLA where necessary to demonstrate compliance with an ARR that is expressed in terms of millirem. Two, dose recommendations, including 15 mm per year, that are mentioned in guidance documents, should not be used as TBCs to establish cleanup levels. Cleanup levels not based on an ARR should be based on the 10^4 to 10^6 cancer risk range, with 10^6 as the point of departure and 1x10^6 used for PRG. And three, estimates of risk based on direct exposure rate measurements of penetrating radiation may be used to supplement sampling. Okay, let's turn to page 69. EPA has developed two soil screening guidance for radionuclides, also known as RAD-SSG documents, both a user's guide and a technical background document, also known as a TBD. These guidance documents are intended to be used early in the CERCLA process to screen out areas of site, exposure pathways, or radionuclides of concern from further consideration, assuming certain conditions are present, or to determine that further study is warranted at a site. They are consistent with two earlier chemical SSG documents. They include equations for determining concentrations, corresponding to both a 1x10^6 cancer risk using a residential exposure scenario and not causing MCLs to be exceeded in the groundwater due to contamination leaching from the soil. They also include survey procedures for characterizing sites. Use of these survey procedures at concentrations corresponding to a 1x10^6 cancer risk is to ensure that areas of elevated levels of radiation are not missed. The TBD includes an evaluation of five more detailed soil-to-groundwater models. Okay, let's move on to page 70. EPA has developed an online risk assessment tool entitled Preliminary Remediation Goals for Radionuclides Electronic Calculator, which is also known as the RAD-PRG Calculator. Unlike the guidance documents that are discussed during this training, the RAD-PRG calculator is updated frequently to reflect EPA's latest risk assessment recommendations. The calculator provides generic 1x10^6 cancer risk-based PRG concentrations that are derived using standardized exposure assumptions. It can also be used to create site-specific concentrations by modifying the default exposure assumptions with information gained site-specifically. The calculator should be used for calculating radionuclide PRGs for residential, indoor workers, outdoor workers, and agricultural land use exposures, tap water, and fish ingestion exposures. The calculator also presents PRG to protect groundwater from migration of radionuclides from soil. Let's go to page 71. The calculator is used to establish PRGs when there are no ARRs available that are sufficiently protective. For determining the chemical toxicity of uranium, EPA has developed a soil screening level for chemicals that is also on the Internet. EPA has also developed with the radionuclides team of ITRC an Internet-based training on the usage of the PRG calculator titled Radiation Risk Dose Assessment Updates and Tools. This is what Tom Schneider referred to in the last Q&A, last Q&A session. So let's move on to page 72. EPA has also developed an online radionuclide ARR dose compliant concentration electronic calculator, also known as either the ARR dose or DCC calculator. Like the RAD PRG calculator, the ARR dose calculator is also frequently updated to reflect EPA's latest guidance. It's important to note here, again, that it's EPA's policy that at surplus sites, cleanup levels should be selected using risk derived from slope factors, not millerim derived from dose conversion factors, except when based on ARRs. Dose assessment should only, can't stress that word enough, only be conducted at surplus sites to demonstrate ARR compliance. The ARR dose calculator is set up in a similar manner to the PRG calculator. It includes the same exposure scenarios, except it leaves out the soil to groundwater scenario. The equations in the scenarios are essentially the same, except the ARR dose calculator uses dose conversion factors instead of slope factors, and a year of peak dose instead of risk over a period of exposure such as 30 years. The ARR dose calculator does include both ICRP 26 and 60 dose conversion factors. EPA recommends that ICRP 60 DCS be used for ARR compliance unless the ARR specifies some other dose conversion factors as a requirement. Both the PRG and ARR dose calculators also include an online user guide. This user guide provides information not only using the calculator, but also on the sources, such as default parameters used in the calculator. It's important to note that both the RAD PRG and ARR dose calculators are consistent with how EPA assesses risk from chemicals at Superfund sites, except to account for technical differences between radionuclides and chemicals. This enables users to have a harmonized approach as endorsed by EPA when addressing radiological risk and dose and chemical risk at the same Superfund site. Okay, let's move on to page 73. Moving away from risk and dose assessment, we do have one groundwater guidance I want to discuss that focuses on radionuclides. It is entitled Use of Uranium Drinking Water Standards under 40 CFR 141 and 40 CFR 192 as remediation goals for groundwater at CERCLA sites. This memo addresses the use of uranium MCL standards and groundwater standards for uranium 234 and 238 issued under UMTRCA. This guidance has two attachments that are useful when complying with other radionuclide MCLs. One, a list of radionuclides that are addressed by the 15 picocuries per liter gross alpha MCL, and two, a list of radionuclide concentration calculated using the 4 mm per year MCL for beta particles and photon emitters. These concentrations should not be calculated site-specifically. Okay, let's turn to page 74. There are many different methods for addressing groundwater contamination. This slide is showing you a picture of a pump and treat system being used at the Hanford site in Washington State. Radiological contamination in groundwater at Hanford includes thorium-90, carbon-14, technetium, uranium, and tritium. Some of this contaminated groundwater discharges into the Columbia River. Okay, let's move on to page 75. Here you see another method to remediate groundwater. This slide is showing you a picture of two types of the most common types of permeable reactive barrier walls, or PRBs. These are continuous PRBs and funnel and gate PRBs. PRBs have been used at several radioactively contaminated sites. For long-term remediation, they become cemented by calcium carbonate and sulfate minerals, which necessitate replacement. ITRC has a team that works on PRB issues and are offering training on PRBs that you can find on the ITRC website. Let's move on to page 76. Next, we come to a memo that requests EPA regional offices consult with EPA headquarters on CERCLA response decisions involving either on-site waste management of radioactive materials, or when there's a potential national precedent-setting issue related to radioactive contamination. This consultation request is for CERCLA response action that are paid for by the fund or private industry, but is also available for federal facilities and RCRA corrective action sites. Okay, let's move on to page 77. Back when EPA and NRC were having a very public disagreement over what constitutes acceptable cleanup levels of radioactive contamination, EPA developed a guidance entitled Evaluation of Facilities Currently or Previously Licensed NRC Sites Under CERCLA. This memo was in response to EPA increasingly receiving requests to either conduct response actions under CERCLA at a previously or currently licensed facilities, or make a determination if a past or proposed NRC decommissioning would meet CERCLA cleanup levels. To make it clear that EPA headquarters was not encouraging regions to go out and conduct lots of evaluations of NRC sites. The key message in this guidance is when conducting a protectiveness evaluation of NRC decommissioning, EPA's determination should be made using site-specific information, such as the radionuclide concentrations in soil and groundwater, not the dose limits in NRC's rule. The guidance also says that if a CERCLA response action is being considered at an NRC facility, the decision should be made using the same process as for other types of facilities. Okay, let's go to page 78. EPA and NRC developed a memorandum of understanding to establish a framework for coordination between EPA when acting under the CERCLA authority and NRC when a facility licensed by the NRC is undergoing decommissioning or when a facility has completed decommissioning and NRC has already terminated its license. EPA believes that implementation of the MOU between the two agencies will ensure that future confusion about dual regulation does not occur regarding the cleanup or use of NRC licensed sites. The MOU was distributed to EPA regions through a transmittal memo entitled Distribution of Memorandum of Understanding between EPA and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. This transmittal note includes guidance to EPA regions to facilitate regional compliance with the MOU and to clarify that the MOU does not affect CERCLA's actions that do not involve NRC. For example, the MOU does not establish cleanup levels for CERCLA sites. Okay, let's move on to page 79. One document that EPA developed for the general public rather than EPA employees is entitled Common Radionuclides Found at Superfund Sites. This booklet is intended to help the general public understand more about the various common radionuclides found at Superfund sites. The booklet contains 12 radionuclide-specific fact sheets that answer questions such as, how can a person be exposed to the radionuclide? How can it affect human health? How does it enter and leave the body? What level of exposure results in harmful effects? And what recommendations has EPA made to protect human health from the radionuclide? It also includes plain English summaries of many of EPA's policies for cleaning up these radionuclides. Okay, let's go to page 80. One other tool for the general public that EPA developed is a 19-minute video entitled Superfund Radiation Risk Assessment and How You Can Help, an overview. This describes the Superfund risk assessment process for addressing radioactive contamination. More specifically, the video answers, what is the process? How does it work? And most importantly, how members of the public can be involved. Okay, let's move on to page 81. This now concludes Module 3, our review of EPA's guidance and tools for addressing radioactively contaminated CERCLA sites. I hope that this module has helped you understand which guidance documents and tools should be looked at to potentially help you address a particular situation at your site. I also hope that you remember to keep checking the Superfund Internet pages listed here to see when new guidance is issued in the future. We'll now move to Module 4, in which Tom Schneider will discuss the challenges associated with long-term monitoring and surveillance of sites that are not being cleaned up for unrestricted release. Hey, Tom.
Thanks, Stuart. As Stuart stated, radionuclide sites are not, or sites in general are not always cleaned up for free release standards, and this is particularly true for radionuclide contaminants. Thus, consideration of perpetual site maintenance, otherwise referred to as long-term stewardship, operation and maintenance, surveillance and maintenance, various names that are provided to it, is warranted for consideration. It's important to keep in mind how we can implement that and how during remedy selection, it's important to keep that in mind, even though it might seem such a long time away. one example I can provide is just based on my personal experience at Fernald, is that in our major cleanup decision document, the Aprobina 5 rod, it simply says, and there will be institutional controls. That's basically the extent of discussion of the long-term management of the facility. And that obviously is limiting. It doesn't provide very good direction, and it's something we had to face after the fact. And it's certainly something that should be considered in more depth as decisions are made in the CERCLA process. Moving on to slide 83, I'll talk a little bit about the purpose of the survey that we're going to talk about here in this portion of the training. In order to better understand and learn from each other, we conducted a survey to learn of regulators' perspectives on long-term stewardship. That document, the LTS document that's referred to on this slide, then compares the results of our survey to three other documents that address long-term stewardship issues. Again, as stated previously, this document's available online to the internet, the ITRC website. For more details on the survey, we'll move on to slide 84. The survey focused on state regulators from states with DOE sites in them, and with regulators who had experience with long-term stewardship. And in particular, it's important to note that this survey focused on individual regulators' perspectives, not a state position for with regard to the answers. So they didn't go survey the governor for an answer. They basically provided answers based on their experience working on DOE sites. There were 31 respondents from 7 sites. It's a very high response rate, and a 70-80% response rate. There were 2 big DOE states missing, and that was due to no response to the survey. And those were Nevada and Idaho, both having big sites, but no responses. The survey was 165 questions long, and the fact that folks were willing to stick through it for about 45 minutes to an hour showed a true interest in the subject and the part of those folks who did fill out the survey. The figure on the slide shows the states that did participate in the survey. Moving on to slide 85. The survey was made up of components that addressed various aspects of long-term stewardship, first being physical engineering controls. Those are like caps and reactive barriers, both of which, by the way, there are ITRC teams and products associated with available with more information on the website. Institutional controls, which are deed restrictions, consumption warnings, those kind of things. Monitoring that evaluates the ongoing operation and effectiveness of a remedy. Information management, how do we remember what we did or pass on to the next generation or generations what occurred at the site and what's supposed to occur at the site. Our ability to forget as humans and as a society should never be underestimated. It's a critical role of information transfer. And then finally, periodic review of remedies and how decisions are evaluated going forward. These were the various components of the survey. Moving on to slide 86, I'll talk about those components and the results. With regard to engineering institutional controls, the respondents were well aware of a number of documented failures of institutional controls. They emphasize the need to look at ways technologies can help our ability to improve the reliability of institutional controls, and suggestions such as using GIS or remote sensing or other tools to evaluate and reinforce institutional controls was emphasized. Also, the importance of layering institutional controls such that if one fails, another will catch it along the way was emphasized. We'll move on to slide 87. Where we discuss monitoring and maintenance. There's a serious emphasis by the respondents on the importance of technology that might be used to supplement and expand upon the current monitoring abilities, and the focus on the importance of monitoring to ensure that the systems maintain their protectiveness. A good example of how monitoring may be improved in the future is in disposal cell monitoring, where the current guidance and regulations require monitoring of groundwater around the landfill, along with leachate flows. This documents a problem sort of after the fact, after the waste has been released from a landfill and into the groundwater, which is sort of too late. Going forward, looking at monitoring methods that forewarn a failure may be a better way to do it, something that may allow you to prevent failure rather than respond to it. So be cap monitors or remote sensing of cap moisture or vegetation are all potential ways that going forward may be ways to improve upon the monitoring of these systems in the long term. An example of this might be the sensors that were installed in the first cap at the Fernald site that looked at soil moisture profile across the cap. The big issue being, though, that the regulations haven't caught up with the available technology, and DOE chose, because there weren't regulations to require that kind of monitoring, to abandon the system and basically eliminate any potential to forewarn of a failure and maintain the current regulatory profile, which tells you after the fact. We'll move on to slide number 88, information management. I talked a little bit about the importance of passing this forward and the fact that people quickly forget. Successful information is going to be, information management is going to be essential for a number of reasons. You need it to correct any remedy failures. You need it to provide assurances to stakeholders, new stakeholders who may have been to the inner areas, or stakeholders who may have forgot what occurred, and to provide a historical understanding of the context in which decisions were made, so that when future folks come in and ask questions about why you did what you did, there's an understanding of what and when it occurred. You know, a simple example would be having as-builts of some of the disposal units at Fernald would have made life a lot easier in remedying those and cleaning those up. So if we had as-builts for the waste pits where multiple years of waste were disposed of and in varying proximities to the underlying aquifer, we'd have a much better idea when we were digging those up where we might encounter the aquifer and where we weren't going to, or whether there was a liner or whether there wasn't a liner. Those kind of information is amazingly easily lost over generations or over tens of years. Moving on to slide 89. Talked about periodic review and communication. It was quite clear the importance of communication both forward and backwards in history and within the local peer group or stakeholders to ensure good remedy decisions and ensure the long-term protectiveness of those remedies. Without the communication to the community and those involved, there's going to be some drop in the process where information is lost and questions will be raised, and you may be refacing the same issues you did once before. Respondents recognize the importance of ongoing community outreach, communication to ensure remedy protectiveness, and the communication was essential in various formats, whether they be meetings or fact sheets or other methods to get the information out to the local folks. And they also pointed out that the Citizen Advisory Board had been an excellent example of that method of communication that worked around the DOE complex. It's sad to say that a number of those cabs have been lost over time and haven't been continued in most cases within LM. It's important to note how very quickly, the public can forget about decisions or the public around the local site will change as populations change or changes occur in the local economy, and that can quickly result in changes to the stakeholders and the views about a site and oftentimes result in reevaluation of a remedy by the citizens, if not the folks who did the cleanup. Moving on to slide 90. The radionuclides team is going to be focusing on the D&D document that I talked about earlier, and we expect that document to be published in the fall of this year and intent-based training hopefully next year. And with that, I'll pass it on to Juliana for the final Q&A and wrap-up.
Thank you, Tom. Before we do the Q&A, let's go to the links to additional resources. On slide 91, if you select that area of the page that says links to additional resources, you're going to go to our links page. We also have listed the URL, as this page is going to continue to be available as a resource for you. On the links page, the first link I want to point out is on the far left in the boxes, the fourth one down is feedback. And we do want you to fill out the feedback form before you leave the site today. The RADS team is working on a new internet-based training, so we have a great place to apply any feedback that you're providing for us. And we do look at those feedback forms, and we appreciate getting information from you. Looking to the right in the links to additional resources, section 1 is some recommended reading. In section 2, we have the ITRC specific links. You can download today's presentation slides. In addition to the information you've seen on the slides themselves, there's more text available in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded versions. The next links are going to take you to the ITRC website, to the RADS team's guidance document page. And there are several documents now listed on that page. All the documents that the team has published are available there. And you can download those and in some cases order hard copies. In Section 3, we have some EPA Superfund resources. And if you move down to Section 4, there are some EPA non-Superfund resources. So this is information that is available and will continue to be available for you. We do now want to take time for questions. Would someone on our phone line like to start with a question? A reminder to take your phone off of mute, and if you've used our system, it is *7 to unmute the phone. And for our simulcast audience, it's that orange question mark button that will allow you to send in a question. A simulcast question from Cassandra Bloden at Navajo EPA in Window Rock, Arizona. Since there are several different instruments used for site assessment, is there a calculation for counts per minute into picocuries or other units?
Yes, there are. Top of my head, I can't remember exactly what that conversion is, but we can...
Won't that be relative to radionuclide, though, Carl?
Right, it's radionuclide specific, but we can, if you have a specific radionuclide in mind, we could send that information to you.
So, yeah, you'd have to know exactly what radionuclide is giving off the CPMs in there to be able to make that conversion.
Right.
A little self-advertising, the real-time document and training talks a lot about using detectors for evaluating concentration. So you might look at those documents in that training course.
And that document concentrates on two main types of detectors that detect gamma radiation. It also talks about how you can use a substitute detecting gamma radiation for estimating types of other radiation. For instance, alpha emitters can be estimated from their associated gamma emitter daughter products.
From Michael Sills at the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services in Concord, are there any air monitoring components for rad materials in either the remedy or post-action phase, especially when landfill gas is involved, which may overcome any density effects?
There are air monitoring requirements for most of the remediations that I'm aware of with regard to particulate monitoring, primarily around the perimeter, both from a worker exposure scenario and for a nearest neighbor type exposure scenario, requirements during the remedy and oftentimes of a disposal facility. I'm not quite sure about the landfill gas side of it, though, which radionuclides would be which would need to be looked at in landfill gas, but there certainly is air monitoring requirements for the particulates and for, like, if you have a radium site radon gas. So,
from Ralph Pierce at the Navy in San Diego, California, has EPA discussed with NRC how the implementation of the 2005 Energy Act will affect federal sites that are already substantially along in the CERCLA process related to radium? Will sites with residual radium contamination, ongoing cleanup, post-remediation, now come under NRC license requirements with the 2009 implementation of the Act, in addition to CERCLA requirements?
Well, when CERCLA actions are on site, we actually don't have to get permits or licenses. It's uncertain how much of this material is going to end up being licensed by NRC, and there have been some discussions when the regulation was first proposed. And I think probably there will be some more discussions, too, as the regulation takes its final shape. So that's about all I could really go into detail on that.
Thank you. Do we have questions from our phone line audience? From William McConan at CH2M Hill in Richland, Washington, what are the requirements for using models to help determine TRGs in soil that are protective of groundwater?
Well, as far as the, as Tom mentioned earlier, I mean, this is covered in more detail in our other training on the risk assessment and dose assessment, which was archived and up on the internet. But in the PRG calculator, there is a very simple soil to groundwater portion that you can use. But if you're really, if that looks like you might be exceeding the level that protects groundwater, then there's in the soil screening guides for radionuclides technical background document, there is a discussion of five more sophisticated soil to groundwater models, and you should probably be looking at a more sophisticated soil to groundwater model at that point, as opposed to a very simple screening model, which is very conservative.
The next question refers to slide 60 from Paul Caffrey at Mass DEP in Boston. On slide 60, what are the units on the radon in building 0.02 working levels?
The 0.02, the working level is the units. So it's, that's actually part of the regulation.
Would someone in our phone line audience like to ask a question? Carrie Whistleby at the U.S. Forest Service in Ketchikan, Alaska. I am planning on being an OSD, or surplus site, at a uranium mine that has contaminated tailings. I am unfamiliar with the safety and health concerns regarding this type of contamination. Are you aware of any available training that covers how to safely be in the field at a uranium-contaminated site?
Juliana, can you repeat that one more time for me?
Sure. From Carrie Willoughby at U.S. Forest Service in Alaska, I am planning on being an OSD or a surplus site at a uranium mine that has contaminated tailings. I am unfamiliar with the safety and health concerns regarding this type of contamination. Are you aware of any available training that covers how to safely be in the field at a uranium contaminated site?
I think there's actually a US EPA course on radiation sites that, is that right, Stuart? Do you remember that? Is there
one? Yeah, Rob and I were talking with a mute on, and we think there are actually health and safety training, and it might be specifically for OSDs. We'll have to get back to you on that. I'm pretty sure I know who actually developed it, but I just need to get back with them on access to the course. We could also we could email that later.
Yeah, Juliana, if you could send that out by email, we can look into some resources that might be available.
We'll do that. So, Carrie, you'll get an email from us later with additional information. Do we have questions from our phone line audience? I do want to wait a couple more minutes to see if we get any simulcast questions in. And while we're waiting, could our instructors talk a little bit more about the new project that you're working on?
Carl, you want to talk about that?
The thing is mentioned and listed in the training, but it is on the contamination and the commissioning of radiologically contaminated sites. There's, as with most of our documents, kind of an emphasis, a focus on the large DOE sites, but includes non-DOE sites as well, and some of the many considerations that you that we took from both guidance and from our mutual experience in dealing with these sites, things that need to be considered when going through that decontamination and decommissioning process. That document is kind of in the draft final stage. It will go through a various reviews over the next several months and be published sometime this fall, we anticipate. And during that, these summer months, we'll be developing the training to go along with that document, and that should be available early next year.
Thank you. We did not get any more simulcast questions, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap up today's training. I'd like to thank our instructors. We really do appreciate you taking the time to be on the call with us today. Thanks also to our participants. We do enjoy having you on the line as well. If you have not already, please fill out the feedback form. For more information about ITRC, you can go to the ITRC website at www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again, and have a great day.